the President of the United States.
U.S. President Joe Biden delivers his State of the Union address.
Not since President Lincoln and the Civil War have freedom and democracy been under assault at home as they are today.
Plus, Japanese and Indian foreign ministers have agreed to strengthen mutual defense and economic ties.
An abiding stake in the peace, security, and prosperity of our region.
And China has some hard words for the United States on the sidelines of its parliamentary meeting. Today is Friday, March 8th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Steve Miller.
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
U.S. President Joe Biden delivered his election year State of the Union address Thursday evening in Washington, where he outlined, a number of initiatives and spoke about the country.
Not since President Lincoln and the Civil War have freedom and democracy been under assault at home as they are today. What makes our moment rare is that freedom and democracy are under attack both at home and overseas at the very same time. Overseas, Putin of Russia is on the march, invading Ukraine and sowing chaos throughout Europe and beyond. If anybody in this room thinks Putin will stop at Ukraine, I assure you he will not.
The address was followed a short time later by Alabama Senator Katie Britt, who provided the Republican response.
President Biden just doesn't get it. He's out of touch. Under his administration, families are worse off. Our communities are less safe, and our country is less secure.
After the address, VOA's Scott Walterman spoke with White House correspondent Anita Powell and VOA national correspondent Steve Herman about the president's remarks.
He clearly enjoyed himself tonight, and he beat expectations that he would keep it under 50 minutes. It was about an hour and 6 minutes tonight. And he covered a wide breadth of topics pretty concisely and with minimal pushback, I would say.
There was some pushback, as we expected. At one point, a male, presumably Republican, shouted out liar. A Republican firebrand, Marjorie Taylor Greene from Georgia, seemed to be heckling him repeatedly. But Trump also gave it back, especially making a number of references without naming Donald Trump. But this being an election year, really contrasting himself with Trump and saying that the former president, who's trying to be the next president, is on the wrong side of history. The most pointed and critical quote is when he said a former president actually bowed down to a foreign leader, talking about Trump and Biden, calling that dangerous and unacceptable, and that he would never bow down.
He's echoing language that he used a few weeks back when he said basically that Trump's comments, and I'm going to repeat them, that he would not defend countries that were late in their NATO dues in the case of a Russian invasion. He would let Putin do, quote, whatever the hell he wants. He's described those as un-American. And he kind of continued that tonight and said, I will not bow down. He also covered, as we expected, a wide breadth of domestic issues focused on the economy. This didn't seem to impress the man sitting right behind him, the Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, who, unlike the Vice President, who was also seated behind him, remained seated for most of the speech. I believe there were two instances where we noticed that Mike Johnson stood up. One was a reference to civil rights protests in the 60s, and the other was on bringing the Israeli hostages back to the States.
And on the other side of the aisle, led by the vice president up there, of course, they're taking their cues from her as well. When she stands up, then they all stand up. And that's very common. We see sort of an overreaction from those with the party in power. And if you have a Speaker of the House who's from the opposition party, then they're not really going to demonstrate that they're a cheerleader for the president, especially when we're in a very strong partisan divide in this country.
Now, if we could shift to Israel and what he said about the conflict in Gaza, there was a little bit of news, of course, that we saw today, which is the United States is building a temporary pier to get more aid into Gaza, because, of course, these airdrops are both insufficient and also you're literally dropping food on people's heads, which presents a lot of dangers. So he also criticized Israel, or seemingly criticized Israel, for not allowing humanitarian aid in. He took a pretty firm line. We did see Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib hold up a sign that said lasting ceasefire now, presumably in response to Biden's call for an immediate 6-week ceasefire. Did you notice anything else, Steve, that struck you about Israel?
Well, I think he tried to balance it, and it was some of the most blunt criticism we've heard of Israel. He was very explicit about the number of Palestinians, 30,000, that have been killed, the massive damage that has been caused. But there were also in the chamber, and he pointed it out, that there are American families whose loved ones are still being held by Hamas. And he said, I pledge to all the families that we will not rest until we bring every one of your loved ones home.
Republican presidential frontrunner and former President Donald Trump also provided a prebuttal prior to Biden's address. In a video released on the X platform by his campaign, Trump said Biden is trying to escape accountability for his actions during his term and, using his TV reality show catchphrase, said it was time to tell the president,
you're fired.
Now, in his State of the Union address, President Biden said that he's directed the U.S. military to build a port in Gaza to facilitate delivery of critically needed aid for Palestinians beleaguered by Israel's military campaign against Hamas. The announcement comes as Michael Fahey, the UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food, said in a speech to the UN Human Rights Council Thursday that Israel was destroying Gaza's food system as part of a broader starvation campaign in its war against Hamas. And Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu delivered remarks saying that Israel's military will continue its operation against Hamas in Gaza, adding that whoever tells Israel not to act in Rafah is telling Israel to lose the war. We're also following these other stories from around the world. Sweden on Thursday ended decades of post-World War II neutrality and became the 32nd member of NATO, as the West's key military alliance confronts the third year of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Millions of travelers across Germany are being affected by strikes after two unions called for two-day walkouts over wages and work conditions. Around 80% of all long-distance trains, as well as regional and commuter trains in the country, were canceled early Thursday as train drivers went on strike. Air travel was also affected. And Friday marks the 10th anniversary of the disappearance of Malaysia Airlines flight MH370. There were extensive searches after the Boeing 777 left Kuala Lumpur with 239 people on March 8, 2014, and dropped off radar screen shortly thereafter and never made it to Beijing. Japanese and Indian foreign ministers on Thursday agreed to strengthen mutual defense and economic ties amid growing Chinese influence. VOA's Rick Pantaleo has that story.
India's Foreign Minister Subrahmanyam Jaishankar told a press conference how his country and Japan are reaffirming and expanding their bilateral security and economic cooperation.
India and Japan, as two major Indo-Pacific nations sharing values, history, and interests, have an abiding stake in the peace, security, and prosperity of our region and are ready to play a responsible role commensurate to the needs of our times.
Japan's Foreign Minister Yoko Kamikawa told reporters that Japan and India confirmed their commitment to further cooperation toward the realization of a free and open Indo-Pacific region. Rick Pantaleo, VOA News.
In a few minutes, many ranchers in Panama are making the transition from breeding livestock to much smaller animals.
He believes he has found a way to preserve his country's rich natural heritage and earn a living at the same time.
This is VOA News. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Earlier, China's top diplomat scolded the United States and touted his country's closer ties with Russia. The comments come on the sidelines of a meeting of China's parliament. We hear more from VOA's Bill Gallo.
China's foreign minister escalated his country's verbal attacks on the United States at a news conference in Beijing Thursday. Wang said, where is the credibility of a great power if the United States always says one thing and does another? Where is the confidence of a great power if it becomes tense and anxious at the mere mention of China? That tone was a contrast from September, when U.S. President Joe Biden met Chinese President Xi Jinping in California. That meeting helped stabilize U.S.-China ties. On Thursday, Wang Yi accused Washington of not honoring its promises and said the United States is trying to contain China through sanctions. Wang said the desire to heap blame on China under any pretext has reached an unbelievable level. Even as high-level talks resumed, the United States has expanded sanctions against China on a range of issues, from human rights abuses to its relations with Russia. At his news conference, Wang defended China's support for Russia, even amid Moscow's war in Ukraine. He also kept up pressure on Taiwan ahead of the inauguration of a president Beijing views as a separatist. And amid an increasingly tense territorial dispute with the Philippines in the South China Sea, Wang vowed to respond to what he called provocations and interference by outside forces. The comments came as China holds an annual meeting of its rubber stamp parliament under tight security in Beijing. The meeting aims to present a positive spin on the many problems facing China's economy. Many analysts see Wang's comments as a way to set the tone for China's foreign policy for this year. If so, there may be no shortage of problems for China to navigate. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Beijing.
Haiti's government on Thursday said it would extend a state of emergency in its West Department, that's the seat of the capital city, for another month after an escalation of violence from gangs seeking to oust the prime minister while he remains abroad. Karen Chamas from the Associated Press takes it from here.
Haitian politicians are desperately trying to form new alliances as the country descends into lawlessness fueled by gang violence. Haiti remains largely paralyzed, with schools and businesses still closed amid heavy gunfire, blamed on the gangs that control an estimated 80% of the capital. The country's embattled Prime Minister, Ariel Henry, has faced increasing pressure to resign, which would likely trigger a US-supported transition to a new government. Bill O'Neill, a human rights expert on Haiti, told the AP,
I've been working in and on around Haiti for 30 years now, and I've never, ever seen it this bad. It's absolutely catastrophic.
One new political alliance has been formed between former rebel leader Guy Philippe and ex-presidential candidate and senator Moïse Jean-Charles. Charles told a radio station that they signed a deal to form a three-person council to lead Haiti. I'm Karen Chamas.
United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres on Thursday called for a cessation of hostilities in Sudan during the Muslim fasting month of Ramadan, which begins early next week.
This cessation of hostilities must lead to a definitive silence of the guns across the country and set out a firm path towards lasting peace for the Sudanese people.
And the Security Council is negotiating a British draft resolution that would also call for a truce for Ramadan in the nearly year-long war between the Sudanese army and their paramilitary rapid support forces. The United States says the warring parties have committed war crimes, and the RSF and allied militias have also committed crimes against humanity and ethnic cleansing. The UN says nearly 25 million people, half of Sudan's population, need aid. Some 8 million have fled their homes, and hunger is rising. A year ago, a 13-year-old girl, Muska Saji, and her family fled the Taliban in Afghanistan and ultimately resettled in the United States. Now enrolled in school, the seventh grader understands that an education would not have been possible for her in her home country. Fahim Siddiqui has a story, which is narrated by Bejan Hamdard.
13-year-old Muskar Shahjay may look like a typical middle school student, but just a year ago, she had no hope of receiving an education. Shortly after regaining control of Afghanistan in August 2021, the Taliban closed schools to girls above the sixth grade. Muskar's parents say that under the regime, life became increasingly dangerous, so they chose to flee the country. Muskar is now a seventh grader at a school in Mountain House, California, about 100 kilometers east of San Francisco. She says if she were in Afghanistan, she wouldn't be able to attend school and study. Unfortunately, this is the reality for her former classmates from third and fourth grade, who can neither access education nor relocate to another country to pursue their dreams.
If I were in Afghanistan, I wouldn't be able to attend school and study. Unfortunately, this is the reality for my former classmates from third and fourth grade. They are unable to access education and lack the opportunity to relocate to another country to pursue their dreams.
Sirat Shahjay, Muskar's brother, says that they are lucky they could move to the U.S. One of the advantages, he says, is that Muskar can continue to go to school with him. But he is sorry that Afghan girls can no longer go to school, including he and Muskar's relatives and former classmates.
One of the advantages is that Muskar can continue to go to school with me. But I am sorry that the Afghan girls can no longer go to school, including all our classmates and relatives.
The Taliban have not only barred females from attending middle schools, high schools, and universities, they also forbid women from working in government agencies and non-government organizations, and even from going to public parks and gyms. Muskar and Sirat's mother, Zohal Shahjay, had been a teacher in Kabul. Being involved in academia, her top priority has always been her children's education. She says the main hardship in Afghanistan, however, was not being allowed to drive her children home from school. She's thankful that she can now drop them off, pick them up, and help them with their studies.
The main thing for me was that I could not drive when my children were dismissed from school. Our friends took them, or their father. It was difficult for me as I could not pick them up when the school day was ending. Now, thank God, I can drop them off and pick them up and help them in their studies.
Muskar says that she often thinks of the Afghan girls who couldn't leave. She says she prays that the schools reopen and that they get an education and follow their dreams.
I never forget about those girls who cannot go to school. I always pray that the schools reopen and they get an education and follow their dreams.
Taliban officials continue to say that the ban on girls' secondary education is temporary. But critics point out it has been more than 2 years since girls in Afghanistan have been allowed to attend school. For Fahim Siddiqui in Tracy, California, Bejan Hamdard, VOA News.
And finally, many ranchers in Panama are making the transition from breeding livestock to a whole nother kind of animal that's smaller, butterflies. Not only is it good for the planet, but for some, it's proven to be an economic winner. Veronica Villafañe narrates this story from Oscar Subaran.
Breeding and caring for his diverse collection of dazzling butterflies is Jaime Navarro's newfound pride and joy. About 170 kilometers west of Panama City, the former cattle rancher transitioned to butterfly farming a little over 7 years ago after a jaguar attacked and decimated his herd.
I am grateful. Had it not been for the jaguar, we will be cutting down trees, burning and applying chemicals in our struggle for subsistence agricultural production.
Today, he is one of almost a dozen successful butterfly breeders in Panama. In the last year, he says his farm's output shot up from 100 to 600 chrysalises per month.
It's very delicate work, but very interesting.
Biologist Samuel Valdez, the director of the Mariposario Cerro La Vieja Butterfly Sanctuary, had a role in persuading the cattle rancher to convert his plot of land into a butterfly farm.
An area where there is constant rainfall and is very humid, and where this biodiversity exists because the butterflies were already here. We have done nothing but learn to manage the resource.
That includes eliminating the use of pesticides and insecticides to protect the natural habitat of Panama, which is home to at least 1,500 butterfly species. Valdez is training and working with a network of farmers, also helping them navigate Panama's flourishing international butterfly trade.
Panama has a series of regulations for exporting live organisms, such as butterflies. And importing countries also have the requirements to prevent the entry of agricultural pests, for example.
Currently, Valdez says Panama sells about 90% of the butterfly zip breeds exclusively to the Konya Tropical Butterfly Garden in Turkey. Yasin Selvi is its director.
Our greatest happiness is not only having Panamanian butterflies in our garden, but also being part of a nature conservation project in Panama.
A conservation project that led to sustainable butterfly farming, and an alternative that transformed Jaime's life. He believes he has found a way to preserve his country's rich natural heritage and earn a living at the same time. For Oscar Zulbarán in Coclé, Panama, Veronica Villafañe, VOA News.
And this has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, we thank you for joining us. For pictures, video stories, and more, be sure to follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Since the war broke out in Ukraine 2 years ago, the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, has marshaled more than $29 billion that has touched the lives of 17 million Ukrainians, nearly half the country's population. This support has not only helped displaced Ukrainians and those living on the front line survive with dignity, but has helped Ukraine build long-term strength and self-reliance. Isabel Coleman is Deputy Administrator of USAID. She says that one of Russian President Vladimir Putin's goals in invading Ukraine was to bring the country to its knees economically. However, he has failed spectacularly in that goal.
Ukraine's friends, including the United States, European allies, and countries from around the world, work together to help keep Ukrainian farmers able to plant their fields. We here at USAID, we have worked with over a third of Ukrainian farmers to provide them with seeds and fertilizer, with financing, with additional storage when they couldn't immediately export their agricultural products.
USAID has worked to bolster alternate export routes and to marshal investment to restore damaged ports in the Black Sea, said Assistant Administrator Coleman.
We have worked with Ukrainian exporters, providing them, for example, with larger grain railway cars so that they can bring bigger quantities of grain to the Danube ports and onto barges there. We have worked with the ports themselves to provide pilot ships that can go back and forth and bring maritime pilots from land to the ships themselves and speed up the turnaround of unloading and offloading agricultural exports in those Danube ports. We have increased investment in different border crossings to, again, speed up processing.
The strategy is working. Today, the Ukrainian economy has returned to growth. Businesses are bouncing back, and international investment is returning. USAID is committed to improving on this progress, including by supporting policy reforms.
We're looking with the destruction that Putin's forces have wrought across the country to make sure that farmers have access to the energy and the irrigation that they need to be as productive as they have been in the past and even more productive going forward.
Ukrainian agriculture provides food to some of the most vulnerable countries in the world, noted Assistant Administrator Coleman. Supporting this breadbasket is critical to feeding the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.